reference to the time frame that we're talking about in our history and geography study. We're talking about the period of restoration when they are released from captivity under the decree of Cyrus, the king of the Persians, and they are allowed to return and to rebuild the city of Jerusalem. Now, I said turn to the book of Ezra. Interestingly enough, in this timeline, or on this timeline, the book of Esther occurs in the neighborhood of chapter 6 and 7 of the book of Ezra. Now, keeping in mind that we read of this decree that has been discovered by Darius, and how that he is now under penalty of hanging, going to penalize anyone who now stands in the way of the rebuilding of the temple in the city of Jerusalem. And it's during this interim period of about chapter 6, chapter 7, thereabouts, that we read about Esther. And I want you to notice some things. I will probably have a lesson on the book of Esther. It is a fascinating study as we talk about the divine providence illustrated during that period of time. Esther, as you know, if you've read the book recently, you're well familiar with the fact that Esther, her parents died, and her cousin or her uncle, there's some speculation as to which it was, but that's beside the point, named Mordecai, took her in and raised her as his own, and gave her a great deal of teaching that was necessary. But just to make a somewhat of a longer story, a little shorter, we know that Esther came to be the queen of the king Xerxes at this point, and also called, as you'll notice in verse 1, Ahasuerus. And when she became queen, it brought her into a favorable position, of course, with the king, but also a very dangerous position. Esther was a Jew, and we know that there is a man in this context whose name was Haman, and Haman hated Mordecai. Anyone tell me why? He wouldn't bow down to him. That's right. Haman was kind of the king's right-hand man, and it was his desire that when folks saw him, that they bow down to him and pay him homage, and Mordecai would not do that. And so Haman despised him. And he set forth a plan whereby he would kill Mordecai. Now, strangely enough, in the killing of Mordecai, who else would be killed? All the Jews. That's right. All the Jews, including Esther. That's right. Now, the king didn't know at this point that Esther, the queen, was a Jew. But strangely enough, in the second chapter of the book of Esther, you'll see in verse 10, it tells us that Esther had not made known her people nor her kindred, for Mordecai had charged her that she should not make it known. Well, interestingly enough, as the text continues, when this decree is made, by the way, one thing that we want to note about Darius or the kings during this period, when they wrote out a decree and it was sealed, what was the significance of it? Could not be changed. That's right. It was set in stone, so it could not be changed. But when we read about this decree that all the Jews now are to be destroyed throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus, even the people of Mordecai, in chapter 3, verse 6, Haman is just tickled to death that he thinks he's got this thing accomplished, and Mordecai is going to be slain. But Mordecai approaches Esther with somewhat of a deal or a proposition, if you please, to go before the king and to beseech the king on behalf of the Jews. Now that makes Esther chapter 4, verse 11, very important to our study. In Esther chapter 4, verse 11, it says, "All the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces do know that whosoever, whether man or woman, shall come unto the king into the inner court who is not called, there is one law for him, that he be put to death, except those to whom the king shall hold out the golden scepter, that he may live. But I have not been called to come in unto the king these 30 days. What does that suggest that Esther understood if she just walked into her husband, the king? He could put her to death. He had the right, the power, the authority to do that because he had not sent for her. Well, in verse 13, we note, "Think not with thyself that thou shalt escape in the king's house more than all the Jews." What does Mordecai know? Esther's dead anyhow. You think because you're a Jew in the king's house that you're going to be an exception to the rule? Well, of course not. You're going to be killed anyway. And in verse 14 it says, "For if thou altogether holdest thy peace at this time, then will relief and deliverance arise to the Jews from another place." Now, that's interesting to me because what I have on the board is from the New King James translation, worded just a little bit different. "For if you remain completely silent." Well, that's what he's saying when he's talking about holding your peace. But if you just sit by and watch this happen, then deliverance is going to come from somebody. Somewhere else, somehow, some way. Now, we've been talking a little bit at this point about these events in history and how they line up, demonstrating the providence of God to bring forth the Messiah into the world through the lineage of Judah, specifically through the lineage of David. But if all the Jews are slain, how will that be accomplished? Well, it wouldn't be accomplished, would it? And God's not going to let His plan just die on the vine. That's exactly what He's saying. Yeah, whether you do it or not, God's plan is going to happen. But the question is, yet who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this? What an interesting question. Who knows? Well, one of the things that we know about the providence of God is that we don't always know that this is or this isn't the providence of God. Now, the word providence simply means provision. God will make provision or provide. And He would. He would provide for the preservation of His people. Now, Esther, how do you know that the events to this very point have not brought you to the house of the king for this very purpose, to spare these people? Now, that's an interesting question, and we want to contemplate that just a little bit, because the plan of God is going to be fulfilled. We've already studied from Genesis chapter 12, verses 1, 2, and 3, how that the promise had been made unto Abraham, that in thy seed shall all families of the earth be blessed. And we've noted that that was to come to pass through the coming of Jesus. God's going to see His plan through. It's going to be accomplished. Now, I want to turn that off for just a minute. While we have the book of Esther open, I want you to see how Esther replies. In verse 15, it says, "Then Esther bade them return answer unto Mordecai. Go gather together all the Jews that are present in Shushan, and fast ye for me, and neither eat nor drink 3 days, night or day. I also and my maidens will fast in like manner, and so will I go unto the king, which is not according to the law, and if I perish, I perish." Now, how many of us demonstrate that kind of conviction? I'm going to do this, and if I die, I die. Now, whether the king extends his scepter to me, so be it. Whatever comes, it'll just come, and I'll accept it because I'm going to take advantage of this opportunity to do something for the people. Now, as you turn the pages and you study in the fifth chapter, we know that Esther puts on her royal apparel and throws a big feast, and she invites Haman and the king. What was Haman's attitude about being invited to the king's feast? Or should I say the queen's feast? It's noteworthy when he speaks with his wife, his pride. Look, beginning in verse 9. It says, "Then went Haman forth that day joyful and glad of heart. But when Haman saw Mordecai in the king's gate, he stood not up nor moved for him. He was filled with wrath against Mordecai. Nevertheless, Haman refrained himself and went home, and sent and fetched his friends and Zeresh his wife. And Haman recounted unto them the glory of his riches and the multitude of his children and all the things wherein the king had promoted him, and how he had advanced him above the princes and servants of the king." What's he doing? He's bragging. "And Haman said moreover, yea, Esther, the queen, did let no man come in with the king unto the banquet that she hath prepared but myself." What a special guy I am. The queen has invited the king and no one else but me. Well, Mordecai continues to be a problem. And he said to his wife and all his friends, verse 14, "Let a gallows be made 50 cubits high. In the morning speak thou unto the king, that Mordecai may be hanged thereon. Then go thou in merrily with the king unto the banquet." And the thing pleased Haman, and he caused the gallows to be built. Now the sixth chapter, fascinating chapter, begins with a problem the king had going to sleep. You ever have trouble going to sleep? What do you do sometimes when you have trouble going to sleep? You read. Yeah. Well, okay. Well, in this case, he read something very dull in many respects. It tells us that he ordered that the book of the Chronicles be brought to him. He's going to read about the history of the kings. And lo and behold, what does he find in the book of the Chronicles? Yes, Mordecai has discovered a plot that was laid to kill the king. And so the question was asked in verse 5, "What honor and dignity hath been bestowed on Mordecai for this?" Now, what was the answer? Nothing. Now, strangely enough, and perhaps a little bit of humor involved in this, when you look at verse 6, it says that Haman came in, chapter 6, verse 6, "And the king said unto him, What shall be done unto the man whom the king delighteth to honor?" Now look at Haman's reaction. "Now Haman said in his heart, To whom would the king delight to do honor more than myself?" Who would he want to honor any more than me? Now, you've heard of a fellow reading his own press? Haman thinks a whole lot about himself. And so who would the king want to honor any more than he would honor me? Now, that sets the stage for the things that Haman says that the king should do. In verse 7, "Haman said unto the king, For the man whom the king delighteth to honor, let royal apparel be brought, which the king useth to wear, and the horse that the king rideth upon, and the head, and on the head of which a crown royal is set. And let the apparel and the horse be delivered to the hand of one of the king's most noble princes, that they may array the man therewith whom the king delighteth to honor, and cause him to ride on horseback through the street of the city, and proclaim before him, Thus shall be done to the man whom the king delighteth to honor." Now, who does Haman think is going to be on that horse? He thinks he's going to be on that horse, all dolled up and have one of the king's honor guard, as it were, go before the horse and lead him about the city and proclaim what a great fellow he is. But then in verse 10, the king said unto Haman, make haste, and take the apparel and the horse, as thou hast said, and do even so to Mordecai, the Jew, that sitteth at the king's gate. Let nothing fail of all that thou hast spoken. Can you imagine how old Haman's heart must have sunk? It's not me he wants to honor. But it's my bitterest enemy, the man I hate, the man I despise. And who's going to have to lead that horse around with Mordecai on it, all dolled up in the king's attire? Haman is. You talk about adding insult to injury. Not only is he not honored, but it's now become his responsibility to honor the man he hates. Yes. 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 Feeding his ego. Head swollen. That's Haman. And as we look further in this chapter, beginning in verse 13, it says, and Haman recounted to Zeresh, his wife, and all his friends, everything that had befallen him. Then said his wise men and Zeresh his wife unto him, if Mordecai, before whom thou hast begun to fall, be of the seed of the Jews, thou shalt not prevail against him, but shall surely fall before him. Now frankly, I don't understand all I know about that, but his friends and his own wife is pointing out very clearly to him, you're not going to be successful if Mordecai is one of the Jews that you've had a hand in trying to destroy. It's not going to happen. And the best thing you can do is leave it alone. But you know, sometimes our ego or pride gets in the way of leaving something alone. We just can't stand it. In the 7th chapter, Esther has another feast. I find it interesting that during the first feast, the king asked her, what do you want? Just name it. Up to half the kingdom, I'll give it to you. And she doesn't tell him. But in the next portion of the text, she tells what it is that she would desire. In chapter 7, the question is asked by the king, what is thy petition, Queen Esther? And it shall be granted thee. And what is thy request? Even to half of the kingdom. Now, what does she ask for? All right, her life and the life of the people. Now, Haman's got a problem. Because now it's divulged that Haman is the one that has set forth this plot. And Haman begins to beg and to plead. And in verse 8, it says, and the king returned out of the palace garden unto the place of the banquet of wine. And Haman was fallen upon the couch whereon Esther was. Then said the king, will he even force the queen before me in this house? How does that appear? When the king has gone out to consider and he walks back in and he sees where Haman is. Does that look good? A very delicate situation, yes. And so the king is very angry, and he ordered that Haman be killed. Where was he killed? On the gallows that he had prepared for Mordecai. You talk about irony. It just keeps coming and coming and coming and coming in the life of Haman, and in particular in the book of Esther, time and time again. And perhaps it's wrong on my part to call it irony. This is the providence of God. God is carrying out His plan. in a way that would bring Jesus, the Christ, into the world. Now, in chapter 8, we learn that Mordecai is promoted. What position does he now have? The place that Haman had. That's right. Yes. Well, yeah, job opening. Yes. But if you look at verse 4, it says, "Then the king held out to Esther the golden scepter." So Esther arose and stood before the king. Now what does she ask for? Yes. Okay. Essentially for the life of these people. Because the king's decree, there has been a certain time appointed that it's going to be carried out. But there's a problem. Once the decree has been signed, as we mentioned a few moments ago, it can't be undone. But you know, the king can write a new decree. And so what decree does he write? Look at verse 11 of chapter 8. What can they do? That's right. He arms them, or gives them arms so they can defend themselves. And when they defend themselves, then what happens to the Jews? Well, they live. And if you'll note in chapter 9, in verse 5, it says, "And the Jews smote all their enemies with the stroke of the sword, and with slaughter and destruction, and did what they would unto them that hated them. And in Shushan, the palace, the Jews slew and destroyed 500 men." Interestingly enough, in verse 10, they slew the 10 sons of Haman. Dropping down just a little bit further in the text, well, verse 13, you'll note how they were killed. They were hanged. But the Jews' victory is somewhat amplified when we look at verse 16. "The other Jews that were in the king's provinces gathered themselves together and stood for the lives for their lives, and had rest from their enemies, and slew of them that hated them 75,000. But on the spoil they laid not their hand." Now, again, as we look back at the text, it's a great day of joy because the Jews are now going to live. Who did that? God did. God did. Yes, Lon? Yeah, that's an interesting observation, isn't it? Yeah. Well, things are going south for Haman's friends and family, so you wouldn't want to be closely tied to him. Yeah, they became Jews. Well, great day of celebration, verse 22 of chapter 9. And then when you come to chapter 10, just three verses. Randy, would you read that whole chapter for me, please? The whole thing. Isn't that interesting? In contrast to Haman, now we have a good man that's in second in command of the Persian Empire, Medo-Persian Empire. So now we've got somebody that's going to take care of business, somebody that's going to take care of the Jews at this point, and things are going to be good for them. Any question or comment? That's a very quick trip through Esther.
Yeah, what's that?
That's the next chart. Well, it was just a blank chart. Of course, it was a day of celebration for the Jews, so it's appropriate that that be there. Yes. Yes. good analogy. I find it interesting as well, when Joseph made provisions, it was to save this people alive, he said. That's why he brought them down to Egypt. That's what Esther's doing. When you look at some very brief times in the history of the Jews, we see where they were almost, they almost didn't survive. When you've got 70 here, that's hardly a nation being brought down into Egypt. But when they come out, some tell us some 2 to 3 million people came up out of the land of Egypt. But during the days of the kings, as we talked about, which king was it? Joash, that Athaliah tried to kill all the babies, and the king, or the priest Jehoiada, saved Joash and declared him to be king at the ripe old age of, what was it, 8 years old. And so the people, again, the lineage of David, I should say, got down that close to being extinguished. But it was preserved by Jehoiada, the priest. And so now, once again, it's off to a good start again. And then here again, under this Persian king, we find that the people came very close to being extinguished, but they were not. Now, history is remarkable. Yes. Do I know who wrote it? No. I'm not sure that I can say I do. No. That's an interesting thought. I have some notes. I'll have to go back and rethink that. I don't know. Anybody know? You can probably do some online research right quick and find it. Oh. Oh, yeah. Well, we've got the same time frame. As we mentioned, this story of Esther fits in about chapter 6, chapter 7 of Ezra. Nehemiah just a little bit after, but not much. Yes?
I just get a point out. It's interesting. I don't want to read politics. The current prime minister of Israel addressed our Congress about a month ago. And he brought up the book of Esther. See, this isn't the first time a Persian king has wanted to highlight the Jews. You know, pointing out what was going on in Iran. It's just interesting that it's still an accurate story.
Well, it is, and it's one we need to be familiar with, not necessarily just from the historical perspective of the relationship of the Persians to the Jews, but to see the providence of God. Somebody pointed out to me a few years ago about the book of Esther that though God's name is not used anywhere in the book, you see Him on every page. And we want to take note of that. These people were spared. And they were spared because that was the plan of God. And what it took to bring about His plan, He would do. Even to the extent of using some really bad people. Now, we might raise some interesting questions that we'll just have to shake our head and be amazed at. What if Esther's parents hadn't died? Would that have changed anything? What if Mordecai hadn't raised her and it had been somebody else? Could that have changed the whole thing? Well, yes. What if Vashti had not rebelled against the king and just did what he wanted? Would that have changed the whole thing? Yeah. Yeah, but the whole story would be different. And when you think about such minute circumstances as we might think of them, the king trying to go to bed and couldn't sleep. What if he just fell asleep right away? He would not have read about what Mordecai did. And if he hadn't read about what Mordecai did, then he would not have asked the question, what can we do for this man to honor him? And you just see things begin to domino right down the line of events as you ask all kinds of interesting questions. And just a slight turn at one point or another would have changed the whole series of events. as we said in the beginning of this portion of our study, it's difficult in our life to point at one particular thing and say, well, this is the providence of God. But let me ask you, when we think about the provision of God, do you believe that God's providence still works? Yes. If not, then why would we bother to pray? Why would you pray that somebody's body might respond positively to medication when it just is what it is? Either they're going to live or they're going to die. Why would you pray for the sick? Why would you pray for yourself when there are problems in your life? If you didn't believe that God could turn things, you don't always have the ability to point your finger and say, this I know is the providence of God. But we do know that it exists. For example, when the Apostle Paul was writing to young Timothy about prayer in 1 Timothy chapter 2, we are to pray for those who are in positions of power, that we might lead a quiet and tranquil life. Now, why in the world would you pray that? If things are just what they are, why would you even involve yourself with that? But Paul directed Timothy to pray for that. Now, do we pray for those who are in positions of power? Comment, question? Right. Yeah, we sometimes think that the result of that has to be a miracle. Just has to be a miracle. No. No, God can exercise His will even over circumstances or even use those circumstances. For example, to illustrate the point, you remember in our studies earlier, we were studying from the book of Isaiah. And we noted that Isaiah said, I believe it's chapter 10, beginning in verse 1, would you check me on that, where Isaiah said that, it's maybe chapter 9, verse 1, where Isaiah named the Assyrians, Ho Assyria. And as you read that text, down about verse 2 or 3, he points out that the king of Assyria is going to be used an instrument in my hand. And then he said, though he willeth it not to be so. Why would the king of Assyria want to do anything that God wanted him to do? Well, you see, the king of Assyria, he didn't believe that there was one God to start with. So why in the world would he bow his will to the God of the Israelites? Pardon me? 10 verse 5. Yes, okay. That whole context. And then the following paragraph, I think, begins to talk about the fall of Babylon. But as you look at that, here is a man that God said, I'm going to use, though he willeth it not to be so. That's providence, isn't it? That's not a miracle that God brought this man to power. Wasn't it interesting as well that King Nebuchadnezzar had to learn and be told by Daniel that God has brought you to this place and given you power and dominion and kingdoms, etc., etc.? Who made Nebuchadnezzar king? God did. And at one point, Nebuchadnezzar had a whole lot of trouble with that. But he finally understood it, how it was that he came to be king. Yes, Joy?
God certainly doesn't require anybody's permission. And furthermore, everything was going to remind me of the point that you made in the class of the time past. One of the powerful lessons from Daniel is about rule.
Indeed. Indeed. Well, yes, and one of the things that, again, we have trouble with is saying, well, God took care of this nation. Maybe, maybe not. Maybe that was just an event of history. Whether that was the exercise of God's providence, I don't know. I can't always point a finger at this incident and say, God did that. He may or he may not have. It may have been the events of history just as they unfolded. Or God may have unfolded them in that way. Carolyn? Yeah. 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 And when you look into the New Testament, even the events of the crucifixion, Jesus didn't have to be arrested. He could have avoided it. Even after he was arrested, we've commented on this earlier, he said, I have power over 12 legions of angels. I don't have to die. Chris? No. That's right. Yeah, that was her choice. That's right. Yeah. Well, that's right. Of course, this gets into a little bit more detailed study of the providence of God and the relationship of providence with prayer. God has not promised to answer prayer under every circumstance and condition, aside from our will. Our will is certainly involved in that picture. And there are conditions upon which we are to pray. And that's a whole other study. But yes, we don't want to leave the impression with anybody that God's providence overruled the will of these men. They had choices, but God could use their choices, good or bad. And I think that's the point here made by Mordecai, that if you don't approach the king, then there will be another way. But perhaps you've been brought to this place. And it was her decision to go in before the king. Very good. We need that point. Anything else?
I'm going to say that quotation that says perhaps it's because God wants you here, whether you come to the kingdom for such a time as this, is that we can't know in any situation whether this has been the providence of God or just chance unless God tells us. A lot of people would like to, you know, guess and infer and sorts of events within history through the providence of God, when in fact the Bible doesn't say any such thing.
Well, that's right. I want us to understand that. As I've said a number of times tonight, I don't want to necessarily turn our study into a study of providence and prayer, but I do want us to see this point, that I can't always point a finger at this event or that event and so forth and declare it to be the providence of God. In these cases, we read about it. But nonetheless, we see involved in these cases choices that people made. God didn't hammer His will over their head and make them do something contrary to their will. We must understand that. And we don't need to attribute to God things that we don't know about. But the point being, in our case and in our lives, is I can't deny its existence. Does that make sense? All right. Any other comment or question? David? Well, that's right. That's right. I've got a chart. I kind of anticipated some discussion along this line, and I wanted to get this chart and the following one before you. In the book of Ecclesiastes, chapter 9, verse 1, the wisdom writer said, "For all this I laid to my heart, even to explore all this, that the righteous and the wise and their works are in the hand of God." Now, having said that, look at what he's said prior to that in Ecclesiastes 3, verse 11. Man cannot find out the work that God hath done from the beginning even to the end. Now, when you put those two things together, we see clearly the providence of God. He works. But in chapter 3 and verse 11, you can't always know what God has done, as Richard pointed out, unless He tells you this is what He's done. Okay? Now, this next chart I want you to look at. In Deuteronomy 29, familiar text, and it becomes the answer to a whole lot of questions. The secret things belong unto Jehovah our God, but the things that are revealed belong unto us and to our children forever, that we may do all the words of this law. Now, when we study books like Esther, and when we study this Old Testament history, as we have from Genesis 3 forward, essentially, and we see the plan of God being not only revealed, but occurring as God had planned it, we can't deny the place of God's providence. That's there. And the text of 2 Corinthians 5, verse 7, becomes appropriate. We walk by faith, not by sight. Now, sometimes we get all messed up in our thinking about what faith is. We just believe in God, and we throw out terms like that, like that God's going to perform, as somebody pointed out, a miracle or something in our life. Philip, I believe it was you. No, that's not the case. And we don't need to think that way. What we do need to see is that God is faithful to what He has said. When we talk about walking by faith and not by sight, the apostle writing to the Romans in Romans chapter 1, again, a passage you would do well to commit to memory, beginning in verse 16, he said, "For I am not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God unto salvation to everyone that believeth, to the Jew first and also to the Greek, for therein is revealed a righteousness of God from faith unto faith, as it is written, but the righteous shall live by faith." Now there it is again. We walk by faith, not by sight. The righteous shall live by faith. Now, Paul said in the Roman letter, it's written so. Where was it written? More specifically. Yes. It is a quote. Yes. Where? Yes. Where? 2:4. Habakkuk 2, verse 4. Now, context. Have we not hammer context? What's the context of Habakkuk? He's got a grave concern. We've just studied about some of that. Habakkuk, you remember, wrote prior to the destruction of Jerusalem, prior to the Babylonian captivity, considerably before the time of Darius. And so what did Habakkuk... Yes. Yes, and who did that include? The Jews. Yeah, the Jews. Because he's concerned about the people, the inhabitants of Judah. And what did God say? Babylonians are going to take care of that. And then Habakkuk was very much concerned, as if to say, how, God, can you use them to punish your people when they're a whole lot worse than we are? And what did God say? I'm going to take care of that. Now, how did Habakkuk respond to that? How did he respond? He said something to the effect, I've let all the peoples of the earth keep silence before him. Habakkuk 2:20? Yes, thank you. Habakkuk 2:20. But Jehovah is in his holy temple. Let all the earth keep silence before him. Now, Habakkuk has learned something. Back up, if you will, to chapter 2, verse 4. After God has told Habakkuk, don't you worry, I'm going to take care of all this. In verse 4, Habakkuk says, behold, his soul is puffed up, it is not upright in him, but the righteous shall live by his faith. Now, why is that relevant to us in our discussion of God's providence? Did Habakkuk know all of the details of how God's going to punish his people and how God's going to punish the kingdom of Babylon? He just knew it was going to happen. Now, question. When he knew it was going to happen, did he believe that it was so, that God would do this? Well, yeah. Now, when you bring that thought, that quotation, into the New Testament where Paul said, for I'm not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God unto salvation to everyone that believeth. And he emphasizes, the righteous shall live by faith. Now, when you read it in this book, are you willing to commit yourself to do that even though you don't see the outcome right now? I've used the illustration a number of times, a secular illustration. I forget the man's name. Jenny, you can look that up very easily. The man who crossed Niagara Falls on a tightrope several times. And I've read the story several times, back in the 1800s, about 69, I think. But this man just impressed people that he could walk this tightrope across Niagara Falls. And one story was that he pushed a wheelbarrow across Niagara Falls. Then he pushed it across the falls with a sack of potatoes in it. And at one instance, he reputedly carried his sponsor or man that traveled with him on his back and walked across Niagara Falls. And someone commented about his ability to walk that tightrope, that I believe you could push a man in that wheelbarrow across those falls on that rope. The man said, you do? Yeah, I believe you could do that. He said, prove it. Get into the wheelbarrow. I want to ask you something. When you read about God's plan to save man, you willing to commit yourself to follow it? Even when you don't see all the ins and the outs and all the end of everything. Now, that's what Habakkuk meant when he said, the righteous shall live by faith. You believe what God said and you trust in Him. He's going to do what He said He will do. Now, if you trust Him enough, it can result in the salvation of your soul, you see, if you commit yourself to Him. Now, when we talk about the providence of God, bringing that back to our study, I can't point my finger at every instance of God's providence. Can't do it. But do I see it illustrated? Can I deny that it exists? When I look at the instructions to pray and for what and for whom, can I doubt that God will respond to my prayer? Well, I'm not asking for a miracle. But what I am asking for is for God to grant the thing that I've requested. And these Old Testament illustrations, at least it's my conviction, helps us to see that God will not fail. He will do what He has promised to do. Now, that doesn't mean He's going to grant you everything you ask for. Okay? There's a whole lot of conditions and elements involved in that in another study. But our study is going to return back to the book of Ezra and Nehemiah next time, or the next time. So we'll talk about that some more. Okay, appreciate your comments.